Thank you.
Good morning. I'd like to call the meeting of the Safety and Security Committee to order. First item is our monthly safety message from Jim Doherty.
Morning, thank you, Chairman Downey. If I could start off with certainly pointing out the emergency exits in the event the fire alarm goes off or we have some other emergency in the building that would necessitate evacuation, if you would leave through the exit doors. In the back here, out past security, and we would convene in front of the building museum to make sure that we have everyone there. Our safety contact. With the time change last week, we'd like to remind everyone to check batteries in their smoke alarms and replace if warranted. Over 20% of homes have faulty smoke detectors. Also, we'd recommend that you ensure your home has a dual-purpose smoke detector, both ionization, which is better at detecting flames, and photoelectric, which is designed for detecting smoldering or smoke-type fires. If you have not checked, also you should check and replace the smoke detectors that are over 10 years old, 5 years for carbon monoxide detectors. You may want to consider newer models that are interconnected, where one is triggered if all, or where all are triggered if one smoke detector activates. Additionally, it is a good time, in addition to checking smoke detectors, to ensure that your home emergency kit is up to date and also have a winter car kit. So, thank you, Mr. Downey.
Thank you. Thanks for the reminders. Other questions are on the agenda? I would like to note that at the end where we have the escalator incident, I've also asked the interim general manager to talk about Farragut North and what occurred there yesterday. Any other concerns with the agenda? If not, I've switched it around this month. We'll sort of vary between going security first and safety first so that people get a fair allocation of time. And let me ask Chief Taborn for the security report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and other members of this committee. Today we want to cover one of the relatively new additions to the Metro Transit Police Department, the Office of Emergency Management. And before I start, I would like to introduce to you the director of that office, Peter LaPorte.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm quickly going to hit through some slides. I've been in this emergency management business for quite some time. I was the district's emergency manager from 99 to 03. Prior to that, I was the emergency manager for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Prior to that, I did about 15 years in policing in the NYPD, Boston Police, and here in the Metropolitan Police in Washington. The Office of Emergency Management is a traditional emergency management, covers all phases of emergency management. And I say that with all due respect to all phases. I emphasize to some extent the recovery component, something we've been pretty strong about as we've identified resources that should be coming to the authority and did so somewhat aggressively. You'll see that we did a pretty good job getting all our money back from snow. We were pretty aggressive during the inaugural, making sure we participated in all those components. On the next page, the planning component, something the basic foundations of emergency management, if you will. I'm proud to say about a month ago, the general manager signed for the first time since 1993, a new emergency response plan for the authority. This is something that we take great deal of pride in, partly because, one, it hadn't been done in a long time. Two, it meets all the federal components. It's emergency support function-based. It's NIMS compliant. It's all the things it's supposed to be, and it's more than that. It's ESF-based in a transit environment. There's no other plan like that around the country. It's very detailed, and it's something that, again, we take a great deal of pride in.
When you say NIMS, that's National Incident
Management System, yes.
So we're on the same page in terms of system as all the other responders?
Not just all the other responders here at federal level. We actually, our plan is also emergency support function-based. So ESF is to some extent, the language the federal group plays. It's also the language the district, Maryland, Virginia, and all the local communities. So there's a common terminology, doctrine, if you will, in the business, and we're now compliant with that, and there isn't a transit authority in the country who hasn't come knocking already saying we'd like a copy. Again, in the planning component, we've strongly addressed, we've got a new COOP plan for the building, a terrorism annex specifically, and it's very law enforcement sensitive, so it's housed in our Special Operations Homeland Security Division. This past year, we were able to identify some funds. We worked with safety closely and finished our pandemic flu plan. Didn't really have to use it, but it opened some eyes on a public health component and engaged a lot of the public health departments in our surrounding communities and made sure they knew some of our needs. A couple other plans that we finished, the severe weather plan, specifically snow, but it would include flood, hurricanes, and the like, and put that together, the emergency public information operations plan in an event, how quickly we can get information on different components. The operations center manual, in B1, we created an emergency operations center that's right off of the OCC. Activating that facility, we put some guidelines and components of how it gets activated, how it gets operated, and it certainly came in handy during the snow, but how we ran it was really important. It was 22 situational reports done there. Those situational reports came in real handy when the FEMA folks came and said, show us what you did, and we were able to show time by time what we did. And we're going to talk the next presentation about the Family Assistance Plan, and that's another annex to our plan. Response and recovery, we have a group of real dedicated, talented individuals who make up this component. Each and every rush hour, 5 days a week, both evening and morning, we have people in the OCC. So they're down there, they're listening, they're part of notifications, and they're quickly getting information to senior players, making sure we quickly respond. Just last month, we included an evening shift, which that gentleman actually was at Farragut North pretty early into the evening. We responded to well over 100 incidents now, and we're pretty aggressive when it comes to that and getting in the forefront. And part of it is coordinating the scene, making sure the incident command that's set up knows that some of the components and needs of what Metro's doing, whether we can continue to run through a station, how it works, how it operates, and understanding how some of the things we're doing. Some of the special projects that we've been involved in, we've benefited from the stimulus package of the evacuation carts, the motorized emergency response vehicles. These are the vehicles that really were designed by the regional fire chiefs here in the region after the London bombing in their subways. This is powers down. How do you get further into a tunnel? These are designed throughout the station. Throughout the stations, and it's a pretty interesting. We've been doing a lot of training with the fire departments around the region, and it's something we take great pride of. The AED program, the automated external defibrillators throughout the system, you're seeing more and more of those show up. A lot more training, pretty easy to use, but it's something we've been aggressive. Some of our hires, one of them was the number two in PG County. He's leading the project of their fire department, doing a great job. We've automated our fire maps, and our emergency medical supply cabinets are easily available to the fire departments as they respond. It's just been a lot going on. As you do any type of plans, well, you better test them. You better train, but you also better exercise. And we've done a great deal of training last year, and it's even more this year. Firefighters, but not just firefighters, police officers, not just the regular police officers, campus police, park police, included a great deal of training to the FBI. So a lot of folks coming to us, looking at what we're doing, again, in many ways leading in some ways. Done a lot with the Metro Emergency Response Training, that's really taking ICS to the frontline supervisor level and getting them to understand the terminology. In this past year, we've participated in three tactical exercises that was included an active shooter at Friendship Heights, a bomb on a bus that we played out, and the last one was a pretty significant, over 600 people participating in the tunnels between Roslyn and Foggy Bottom overnight. The whole region participated in, like never before. We're more connected now than ever before with the region, our regional partners, and there's just a sense that we're turning the corner in communications, coordination, and in this business, you're always going to get better. So as good as you are today, you better be better tomorrow. Thank you, sir.
Right, thank you. One question. In an emergency event, under the emergency plan, who is the on-scene commander?
The first person who gets there would be our on-scene commander, but by written process is the Metropolitan Transit Police would be the incident commander. But if it's a fire event, get switched to the fire department. The protocols, though, are pretty extensive. The fire department, if it's extensive enough, will send a battalion chief down to our OCC, and we open up that communication. And I've seen it work very well.
Okay. Any other questions on emergency management? Chief?
Yes, sir. The next slide depicts the MetroStat. You recall last committee meeting, we talked about what the MetroStat would be. It's a way of quickly identifying things that we need to target. And in this case, our primary objective is to look at crime reductions, robberies, parking lot related crimes, youth disorder issues, and thefts of bicycles. We also look at the significant facts, and these are calls for service for the third quarter of the calendar year. And to date, we've received about, in the last quarter, 15,000 calls for service, made over 608 arrests, issued about 2,000 criminal or civil citations for bear evasions, eating, drinking, smoking. There's been an increase of about 2% of bus operators' assaults. And we still track the probability of being a victim of a Part 1 crime in the Metro system is 6.02 per million riders. Next slide.
More.
This is a depiction of...
Question on the slide. The bus operator assaults, you indicated that's about a 2% increase, and my understanding was some of the laws in some of the jurisdictions had been strengthened in terms of prosecuting people. Have you not seen yet an improvement as a result of that? And is there anything else that we need to be aware of that we need to be doing to start to see that number go down?
And again, I misstated the fact. Instead of a 2% increase, there was a 21% increase in bus operator assaults. And the criminal penalties associated with assaulting bus operators have little or no correlation to people actually spitting, throwing objects, or things at bus operators. There's very little concern about the consequences when they have those types of confrontations, many of which sort of stem from fare evasions or fare concerns about fare. And it's that type of interactions that result in either a rock being thrown or cups or bottles or whatever being thrown at the operator, spitting, things of that nature.
Okay. One thing that might be helpful, if I might just follow up a request for information, I would like to see the number of those by jurisdiction and then maybe a chart that also shows what the current law is in those jurisdictions so that we can get a relative idea of, you know, what is the law today? Where are these happening in the system so that we can – I think this is still a vitally important thing that needs to be addressed. I mean, we can't have, you know, our bus operators who have a million other things to worry about being concerned of being assaulted while they're out there on the street. And I think it's something that we still need to work on.
Okay.
If I may look at that statistic, 6.02 per million riders – Chief, the 6.02 per million riders, since we have roughly a million trips, a little over a million trips a day, are you saying that there are roughly six Part 1 crimes per day in or around our system?
No, I'm saying looking at an annual depiction, over 300 some odd millions of people, that's crime is very low in comparison. I brought today the annual report that is submitted to the Council of Governments that depicts all of the jurisdictional agencies, and the numbers that reflect the Metro in comparison to the numbers that reflect the other jurisdictions, it's like this compared to the ceiling. So
you're saying we're safe in Metro. And when you're talking about this, we're not just talking rail. We're talking rail and bus, right?
Absolutely, sir. The whole
but I still want to try and get to a sense of what happens in a day. This reads to me like roughly six crimes in a day.
Well, no, it's more than six crimes per day, Part 1 crimes. Usually there's approximately maybe 20 arrests per day, but they may be for Part 2 crimes. These are Part 1 crimes.
And would you, I say this each time that we meet because it's important for all of us to understand what we're talking about. Part 1 crimes that we're talking about are primarily thefts out of automobiles and snatches of iPods? And
they are the what they is classified as robberies, whether it's snatch, whether it's armed robbery, robbery by fear, whether it's a stolen auto, whether it's theft from a person, and it varies from jurisdictions. In the state of Maryland, it's anything over $1,000, where in Virginia it's anything over $250. So it varies as to the classification of that particular crime.
Can you characterize typically if there are roughly six crimes in a day, and I keep coming back to that because in my head that's what that tells me. What typically would those crimes be, given our experience?
They would be your robbery snatches, where the iPod is taken from an individual. They may include assaults, assault with shot clip.
You're saying may. I'd like to know typically what are they? Are we having a lot of people who have guns put in their face?
No,
or
we're not.
Primarily people's snatches, no. Or something taken out of their car?
80% of our crime is property-related crimes, and most often it is associated with parking lots. So that is where we find a preponderance of crime in our system. Very little crimes actually against person, and those crimes which have seen an increase were those iPods, snatching of iPods from many of our patrons.
Okay, so we're not talking about robbery with force or with weapons being typical. It does happen to some degree.
It does happen, but
this
is
primarily snatches and pickpockets and stealing catalytic converters and GPSs.
Absolutely.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that that context was clear as we were talking about this.
Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, Chief, Mr. McKay's questions made me think about the 28 bus operator assaults. How many of those are actually, the perpetrators are actually caught? I mean, I would suspect that most of them just do something and then run.
Absolutely.
And so we don't really get an opportunity to really charge anyone because they're fleeing the scene.
I don't have the actual percentage. I could get those numbers, but when you take into account the number of buses that we have covering the 1,500 square miles, the assistance that we get from many of the jurisdictional police agencies, and the fact that remains, whether it's the transit police making the arrest or the local jurisdictions making the arrest, there are some arrests associated with some of the bus operator assaults.
So do we catch people 10, 15, 20, 25% of the time or more?
I would say less than 25% of the time. So.
Thank you.
But I can give you those actual figures later.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Again, this is showing that based upon our Metro stat, which is focuses us on looking at crime trends, hot spots, we can pull our resources together and we could target particular areas. Since we've started implementing the Metro stat program, you can see that the crime trends are going down, and we hope that this, in fact, continues so. Again, looking at the crime trends, crimes against persons are down 0.3%, against properties down 52%, bicycle thefts are down. We're moving into another phase of the calendar year, so you'll find those going down. Thefts from autos are down 64%, and overall crime is down compared to the same time last year.
So it's your sense that the Metrostat approach of quick focus and quick adjustment is
paying
off?
Absolutely. I think that is the way that we can rely on our analysis, identifying the times of days, the hot spots, dedicate our resources to those locations, and, again, working in a collaborative fashion with the local jurisdictional agencies also benefit us greatly. This is the depiction of the crime against person. Again, it's looking at system-wide crime. It's looking over on the left, this reporting period of the Metro stat, the prior reporting period, which is 2 weeks prior to that, and then looking at one-year comparison, you'll see that it, in comparison to the last year, it's down roughly maybe 10 crimes, and it goes down continuously. This allows us to look at the assaults, the different categories of robberies. We talked about what that constituted, whether it's force and violence, pickpockets, snatches, things of that nature. Next slide. This is the depiction of the crime against property, and again, it talks about auto thefts, bicycles, theft from autos, parking lot related vandalism, bus vandalism, where there's a rock thrown in a windshield, and rail related crime. Again, in comparison to 1 year, it's gone down almost 50%. This is information that's contained in the appendix, and in previous board presentations, we were asked to identify in each respective jurisdictions the top 10 stations by jurisdictions, and I think the next slide will look at the calls for service, and we have various ways of tracking our calls for service, whether it's a self-initiated activity where the officer initiates a stop for a subject, whether it's a traffic stop, a disorderly conduct, other or public conduct ordinances, whether eating, smoking, drinking, playing a radio without an earphone. So those make up the various calls for services that we've gotten in this particular last quarter.
Do you want us to go to the appendix? Or
no, that's there for people to take a look at. Are there questions further for the chief on his report? Thank you very much. The next item, I skipped over the minutes. Are there any questions, comments on the minutes? If not, can we have a motion to adopt them? Hearing no objection, minutes are adopted. Family assistance plan. This is yes. Something we raised a few months ago. It's something that most regulated transportation providers, such as railroads, airlines, and the like, have in place, and I gather we're in the process of getting ours in place.
Yes.
Hope we never have to use it, but having it in place is important.
And I'd just like to introduce Larissa Alexander from the General Manager's Office. She'll give the presentation. She's been the one who has been pulling this together. And as Peter Laporte mentioned before, the actual operation of this plan will be housed in the Office of Emergency Management.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. Again, my name is Larissa Alexander, and I'd like to update the committee on our progress toward the development of a family assistance plan. In July, the board recommended that we develop a formal plan to provide assistance to victims and their families. With the concerns expressed by the families of the victims of workplace accidents and fatalities, as well as the lessons learned from the tragic events of June 22nd, we gained a better understanding of the importance of providing effective, compassionate response to families. And we used that knowledge in the development of this draft plan. The resources listed here were used to research information germane to metro operations. Our principal source of guidance was from the Rail Passenger Disaster Family Assistance Act. This, coupled with our attendance at the NTSB's training on transportation disaster response for family assistance, helped us to develop what we believe will be a comprehensive plan. Our interaction with victims and their families revealed that we needed a more compassionate approach when working with them. They wanted Metro to understand that little things mean a lot. We wrote the plan. The plan delineates two levels of incidents. Level two is more catastrophic in nature and may require additional support services to augment family needs. The plan will be led by the Office of Emergency Management, and it outlines efforts to provide information, offer assistance with administrative processes, and offer support. And to facilitate this will be the creation of an assistance team. The assistance team is made up of volunteer employees from a cross-section of Metro departments who are sympathetic and genuinely interested in providing assistance to families in need. The team will receive training in a variety of areas to assist them in the fulfillment of their role. A coordinator will lead the team and is responsible for management of the group, assignment of family liaisons, and any additional preparation that may be required for level two incidents. Each family will be designated a central point of contact, a family concierge, if you will, to provide support and minimize any additional burden placed on the family. The liaisons will serve as a conduit for information on the event, provide information on available resources, coordinate requests made to staff, and offer assistance with processes. Liaisons will be assigned from the pool of assistance team members. Going forward, by the spring of 2011, the Office of Emergency Management will finalize the plan and develop a supporting policy. The policy will include training strategies for volunteers and coordination of resources. This concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to take any questions you may have.
Thank you. Is there any action of the board required at this time or in the future?
It's just an update at this time.
Right. Okay. Are there questions about family assistance? Yes.
I'd like to compliment Ms. Alexander and the entire staff that worked with you. This is carefully thought through, I think, very nicely done, and long overdue.
Ms. Hutchins?
I wanted to also do that because I wanted to just step back and think that we have been involved, but we have not had a real plan of how. And it was sort of an after-fact it may have appeared. And so this really does talk about us proactively saying, while we may hope never to have to use this plan, we're prepared. And by doing so, I think we have a much more compassionate and effective way of serving our employees and their families. So I think it's a well-thought-out plan, and hope that we can help avoid using it, but make sure that we are much more consistent with how we apply ourselves.
And we're very appreciative of the volunteer employees who will offer their time and their compassion to this if needed.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, the placement of this office is in the Office of Emergency Management. Is that normally done that way? I would normally think some of these kind of programs run out of your HR offices or such, not the Office of Emergency Management. So that's one question. And is there a financial impact on the program? Certainly I support it, but is it in the current budget that we can support this financially?
Well, there will be considerable coordination with all of the different offices within WMATA, Risk, HR, but we also will be working with the Red Cross and other entities within the National Capital Region. With regards to the financial, I think I would defer to Ms. Kissel or someone else later.
In terms of the financial impact, most of this is done on a volunteer basis. There'll be some other things as we develop the policy that we'll have to talk about in terms of finances.
But it's things we have been doing, but in a less coordinated
yes.
fashion, we'll get them under control.
I left one point out because as you were speaking earlier, do we also coordinate with our jurisdictions in terms of other services that would be beyond this? So we are making
yes.
sure that we're doing
yes.
that.
Yes, we will okay. reach out to yeah. the jurisdictional resources.
Costa.
Yes, thank you. This is a very well done program. I just had a question in terms of clarification. When you say staff will develop a policy to support the plan by spring 2011, when will the actual program start? Is that the same about the same time, or is there another step?
It would probably start right around the same time. We'll properly vet it, submit it to the general manager, in fact, update the board again, and we will sort of memorialize the policy and the program.
But God forbid this something should happen in the next few days. You would be ready to stand this up if needed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, would like to commend you, Ms. Alexander, on the thoroughness of this report and the committee as well. It is indeed very thorough, and while I thought we did a lot of things right, some things wrong. Recently, in the aftermath of the June 22nd accident, our response was reactive in a haphazard fashion. This is very, very detailed and comprehensive, and as Ms. Hudgens indicated, it allows us to be very proactive. And I'm also pleased with the fact that we will be working with the other jurisdictions so that we're not duplicating efforts, and it's a combined effort. So thank you very much for the thoroughness. And Chief, I'm really pleased to see that we'll continue to work with the other jurisdictions and all of the matters that were presented today. Thank you.
Anything else on family assistance? Thank you very much. At this point, we'll turn to the safety report. Mr. Doherty.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Downey, members of the board. Consistent with the request of the board and in consideration of the robust agenda today, I will, highlight some statistical information, and certainly any questions, let me know. Moving to our NTSB update, actually the date, we have closed out 9 of the NTSB recommendations with 12 remaining from the old recommendations, if I could. Earlier this year, as you're aware, the NTSB had made 16 recommendations, 1 to the board, 15 to WMATA staff, and now that response to the NTSB has made from both the board and the staff. We actually sent the response early and are awaiting the NTSB.
We submitted the response. We're awaiting their reaction to it.
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr.
I just want to make sure I understand. When we submit a response like this, are we submitting a cap? What are we submitting?
We submit a letter report that actually has their recommendation, and under that, the response of our proposed corrective action, and that, so it is in the form of a letter cap, if you will, but it is all combined in one letter report.
So each one is the corrective action plan that we now should be tracking to make sure that we implement that plan, and they respond by saying, yes, this is adequate, or no, this is not item by item?
They normally would respond open acceptable or open unacceptable, and then what we do is then we put that on our corrective action plan log, and, you know, and then we track it through our tri-state oversight committee.
So
moving it towards closed acceptable.
I just want to make sure that that I understand that what we sent, and I saw a copy of that letter, that constitutes the official response that they've asked for within the 60 days or whatever, 90 days.
Yes,
and that each explanation's under there is the corrective action plan at this point that we are proposing to do.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Other questions?
Okay, moving on to actually the corrective action plans that we work with the Tri-State Oversight Committee on. To date, 227 corrective actions have been closed, with 29 remaining open. However, please remember that once the NTSB accepts our corrective actions, that will get added to this list, as well as the 2010 triennial audit.
The response to the new audit will add substantially to this.
Yes, sir. And we are...
The ones that we were just talking about are not part of the 29.
That is correct, because the NTSB has not accepted them yet. Normally, what TALK does is add them once the acceptance, be it by the NTSB or the FTA audit, when they accept it, then we add that to the list.
Okay.
But we're still working on them anyway, even though they're not on the official list. This gives you the breakdown still of the remaining corrective actions by year. And we actually have what we call our capture meeting, our corrective action planning meeting next week with the TALK, and we continue to aggressively work to close out the corrective actions. And
at a future meeting, we may want to focus on some of the older unresolved correction action plans.
Certainly.
We don't need to do that today.
Okay. Next, we have our days worked, and this is without any injuries, without an injury occurring cost. You may have noticed in a prior package, actually, New Carrollton was off the list, but it's back on because actually there was not a cost incurred. An employee bumped their head. A reserve was established. However, it wasn't needed. So that actually we're certainly proud that Glenmont is approaching 1,300 days without a lost time injury.
Let me ask a question on that particular chart.
Yes, sir.
Not that I want to highlight this issue, but I'd like to know what the worst ones are, the worst records, not just the best. And are they consistently bad? And if, in fact, there's any actions being contemplated for enhanced training, instruction, you know, whatever, to make them better, if, in fact, the accident was, in fact, possibly by just fault, you know. In other words, if it was no one's fault, then you can't really do much about that, but certainly if there was some issues of communication and other, we'd like to know. But can you comment on that a little bit?
Okay, as far as the worst, I can't, give you the worst of the facilities right now off the top of my head. We can provide
are we looking at the worst ones to see if we can help somehow?
Yes, sir. We are doing that. We're looking at, and part of even our at-risk and looking at individuals with injuries, conducting training, conducting better investigations to actually get to the cause, and also working with the employees and reenacting, if you will, the injury so that we get a good understanding of what occurred so that it doesn't occur again.
From an overview point of view, we have regular superintendent's meetings where we go over, it's sort of like a ComStat thing where we go over how each facilities, pick out certain facilities and go over what they're doing, how they're doing, how they're compared to others, and what plans are in the works to improve things, specific action plans.
Any other questions? Oh,
I looked at this chart, and my first thought was what similarities exist across these various areas when we're looking at them. That is, you talked about the last one that you had with the head injury and the like. Is there somewhere that you're looking at to see whether there's a trend or a pattern of improvement or et cetera?
Absolutely. I mean, we're looking at certainly slips, trips, and falls are common. As far as there's injuries resulting from accidents, where the operators are, claiming injury after an accident has occurred. And, we're looking at everything from are we providing and are the employees wearing proper personal protective equipment, safety glasses, safety goggles, hand protection. So we are looking at all that.
But I guess I use the safety glasses as the example. When you see repetition of that, or do you track or look at it in terms of what's the pattern, or is there a trend, or?
We are doing that now more aggressively, actually with safety officers being assigned to facilities and working with the facility supervision and looking at those. And actually, as you've heard from the chief, as we're doing a metro stat, we're almost looking at a safe stat where the safety staff are certainly there to work with the facilities and determine the causes and what we can do to prevent future occurrences.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I recall recently that there was a issue raised about the availability of workforce safety equipment. I raised a response to try to see whether or not we have a proactive program to maintain inventory, to make sure that we have adequate equipment and there's some way to monitor its availability system-wide. Rather than kind of reactive situation, which I think occurred recently. Could you give me a little bit of information on that?
Certainly. As far as the safety equipment, we are making sure that we have safety equipment from what employees are bringing to our attention, such things as you may have, you know, recently a comment about hot work gloves. We're looking into ensure that we have hot work gloves for everybody, even crews that may occasionally, you know, require that use. I haven't heard recently of, other than, you know, the one case that I just mentioned by one individual. And as we looked into it, the folks that require the equipment have the equipment on a regular basis. So I'm personally not aware, and I will check with the safety staff and see what they're hearing, but nobody has actually brought it to my attention, nor brought it up at our executive safety committee meeting that was just held this past Tuesday, in which we would discuss any of those concerns if they're not addressed at the local level. But I will specifically look into that and get back to you.
Go ahead. Oh, on the day's work, that's a recognition effort. Are you also going to talk about the dinner the other night?
We do. We have that as our final slide, but certainly.
No, that's fine.
There's nothing too significant to report here on the rail accidents. We want you to know that this includes, you know, all collisions, vehicle to vehicle obstructions, and we have had a 16% decrease. And we're also going to focus on the yard events right now.
Looking at the overall incidents, the one that struck me was bus passenger injuries. Can you comment on that?
Sure. I can jump to that slide if we could. Actually, I'm sure, and certainly was something that we looked at that's concerning, with a rate of 5.27 per million passenger trips for the month of September. And during September, that actually is a result of three specific accidents, one that occurred on September 14th, where six passengers were transported and an SUV struck one of our buses. The very next day, September 15th, we had 12 passengers that were transported, and that was an accident between a DC fire truck and a bus. And the last and latest was September 30th, where 24 passengers were injured, and a Metro bus rear-ended another Metro bus. So, bus-to-bus accident, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I too was concerned, but even if you take the September accidents out, we seem to have across the board an increase in bus passenger injuries almost month by month. Is there a reason for that?
From what we can, it certainly is the accidents that are occurring. We are looking at the accidents. We're looking at this trend as well as, you know, even our vehicle-on-vehicle is the last accident, the training programs, working with the bus transportation group and the quality assurance group and the safety officers. So what is, you know, what's there is we're just seeing an increase in the number of passengers claiming injuries as a result of accidents. But what we're focused on certainly is not having the accident in the first place. And it seems that more folks are claiming injury.
These all associated with bus accidents, or can it be an injury because somebody tripped getting off a bus?
It could be, certainly, if somebody's tripping getting off the bus, the slips, trips, and falls on board the vehicles, or getting off the buses at the steps.
So is there some pattern or any type of pattern that is available from the information we've got? Something happening differently?
There's many slips, trips, and falls that are reported to us that are on board. We will define the pattern, but we're also going to utilize DriveCam to assist us more in that, because when we have where a bus is stopped abruptly and someone falls on board, those occurrences are occurring. And that's one of the big areas, certainly, are the slip, trips, and falls, or abrupt stops and folks falling on board the vehicle, vehicles that pull in front of the buses. But we're reviewing the drive cam with that, that will actually give us the, as long as we have the G-force and the drive cam is activated, we will have that information actually.
I would hope that if we see this dramatic, this is a 50% increase, and even
yes, sir,
if you take September out, there's a substantial increase. I would hope that when you bring this kind of data in front of us, you can also give us some idea as to what it is that's changing. If you don't have enough data yet, give us some indication as to where it's going and when you think you can tell us. Because
and what tools you're using,
yeah,
to response, like DriveCam.
Like DriveCam. But you know, what's really important to us is there something going on where there is a broad policy or management action that needs to be taken to deal with an issue that is occurring? But we have to know what the issue is. This just tells us there's something happening, but we don't know what it is.
It is, and that's why we are definitely looking at how we are training new operators and continued training, let me say, on an annual basis or an annual retraining. Something.
But I'm concerned that this may not have anything to do with actual bus accidents. I don't know.
From what we're saying, at this point, it is, but we're drilling down deeper in it. I can tell you in October, there have, you know, we're back October with 10 injuries reported to date, and then, but November, with, you know, just the recent accident, we're at 30, and the month isn't over. So that's what we're looking at, you know, is the number of injuries that were claimed on that accident. So we are looking, because we want to make sure that it's not an anomaly of one month, one occurrence. So we're going back and looking at the whole trending as what's there and the reasons for that. And it's something we got together this week, looked at that, have the safety officers working with the bus transportation folks to see what we can do, getting out more in the fields, getting on the service, seeing what's going, what is happening, so I can provide that information to you.
Mr. Zimmerman?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly agree with the major points that Mr. Benjamin has made. I'm not sure, though, that I see the same thing in the information in front of us, and actually my question is for Mr. Benjamin. I'm not sure that I see in the table what you characterized. The September number is alarming, and you know, certainly worthy of the, you know, the scrutiny you suggested to figure out exactly what's going on. I agree with all that. I don't think, though, that otherwise the table in fact shows a month-by-month increase.
Oh, I look at February and March and April and June.
Let's
and
look
July.
All the way across it. If September were normal. Mm-hmm. That is to say, you know, within the range of all the other data in 2 years there, then the 2010 number up through that point wouldn't be much different than the 2009 number.
But it would be higher, and I think
it would be slightly higher. Yeah. But if you look at the other ones, there's a certain amount of variation in relatively low numbers that seems to go from a low of around 4, and the lowest number was in fact in 2010, and a high of 16, which in 2010 occurred in March, again, other than September. In 2009, it happened to occur in May. But it looks to me like it bounces up and down. I don't know that we see a trend there. It's the September thing and the possibility that November is also, that I agree is you know, raises a big question. On the other hand, I don't have 10 years of data here either. I only have the two. So I don't know that there aren't just, you know, I mean,
what's
I think
the natural like, variation?
Like murders that occur, you know, in a jurisdiction like mine. There aren't very many. You know, you get a couple in a bad things year, you're statistically, it's a 100% increase, you know. But they're low numbers. So, you know, I think trend is really what we have to look at. We have to look at, you know, how you get a number like September so much higher than anything else. I think without, absent that particular month, 2010 doesn't look to me different than 2009 does. I don't think there's a statistically significant difference in that series of numbers. But what's going on in September and what may be since then, I think that is something we need answers to precisely the questions. That
yeah, could we get a 10-year trend analysis? Take a look at what has been happening.
Yeah. I believe we can. I mean, I have that I just received actually yesterday, which is 10 years, but it's only the last 3 years. But
we
see how far back we can go in our data to provide you that information, as well as we've broken it down by district or division to see exactly where there, you know, where there's an issue that we can certainly work on.
Mr. Chairman, one quick question. Oh. If I might just one thing. Just could somebody remind us how many bus passengers we have in a year or in a month, let's say? How many bus passengers are there in a month?
Ask if I could.
That's a day.
$20,000.
$20,000 a day, right? This is monthly data. So, you know, again, I just, any injury is a serious thing. We don't ignore anything. But just to put things in perspective, if you're talking about, you know, 4 to 12 or something like that, in a month, 400,000 times 20 plus weekends, I mean, you know, that is a very small number. It's the move from a number that goes from, you know, 10 or 12 or 8 up to 56 that jumps out and says, okay, what's going on here?
Yeah, in looking at September, just looking at a raw number like that, it is kind of misleading. You know, we don't know, at least I don't know at this point, how many of those incidents, how many occurred, how many were in each of those incidents, whether it was the driver's fault, whether it was somebody driving into the back of the bus, which I thought a few incidents were those kinds of things. So how many times were we the instigator versus not the instigator? So looking at a raw number like that can be misleading. I think we had a few crashes that were large numbers of injuries, as I recall.
Yes, sir. That's correct. As I had mentioned, on September 14th, an SUV struck us, and if I'm not mistaken, the SUV operator was cited by the police. Now, on the September 15th accident, that's where there was a bus accident with a DC fire truck, and there's certainly, you know, we've been looking into that. The operator had the green light. The fire truck approached the intersection, turned on their lights and siren at that point, proceeded through, thought they would clear the bus, is what we're told, and we had that collision. And then September 23rd, September 30th, we had 24 injuries where one of our own buses struck our own bus, obviously.
Yeah, okay. That's, so there was a variety of incidents there,
yes, sir.
Some of which could have been avoided.
Any other questions on the... safety data?
Sorry, yes. Just to clarify, though, these are all injuries that are reported that relate to a bus, right?
Yes, sir.
So they're not necessarily associated even with an accident.
No, it's could be a slip and fall.
Right, I know, but it bears repeating, and maybe yes. That is, I think, is that one of the ones you mentioned?
Yeah. Slips and falls as people are getting on and off buses, or somebody who trips inside a bus, or...
You know, even there, if you see a big trend, it may be telling you something about equipment or something else, about practices, but you don't know until you...
Well, and as you point out, the rate is at the top there. I also thought that there was a chart on rail passenger injuries, which I believe is much, much lower.
Well, we had the rail incidents, the total incidents where in 2009, the injuries one, I believe you should have that in your package, but because it was the lower rate and wasn't of, you know, of significance, we actually didn't put it up on the board.
The rail number, it isn't in the package? Because I'm going by the one that was sent to us.
54.
Okay. 54. Okay. Yeah. That one looks pretty impressive. And it also, of course, the difference between 09 and 10 is the June 22nd accident. But even with that gone, we seem to be doing substantially better in terms of our passenger injury rate, which, again, also includes people who are slipping on a platform or getting injured on an escalator or...
If they report it to us... aware, actually, with some of the trends. If they don't, we wouldn't know, but for those that are reported, yes, sir.
That's a very impressive set of statistics. You know, 0.14 per million passenger trips.
Really good statistic.
Do you have any updates?
Go ahead.
Do you have any updates on the door openings? Anything that you can elaborate on? A door on...
Not on at this time. I mean, there's, you know, not anything that's... significant that I'm aware of at this point. I don't know if Dave is familiar with any door opening events that I'm not aware of at this point.
Not at this time, other than our actions that were taken to, you know, make repairs and adjustments to the systems that we have.
And door closings?
I thought we did have some incidents of doors opening at the wrong time or on the wrong side. Recently, and obviously those didn't result in injuries, so they're not factored in here. But I have heard recent accounts of that, and I think that's what Ms. Hewlett was asking.
Was that misinformation?
I know we have, you know, folks are getting the doors, you know, folks have been shutting the doors as the operators close the doors on the crowded platforms. That, you know, aware. But as far as wrong side door openings, I'm not really familiar with anything of recent other than before when we had mentioned it to the board.
So there has been no wrong side openings recently?
The only thing that I'm really aware of, maybe over the past couple of months, we might have had some wrong side door openings, but not like a major rash or anything. And as far as that, you know, the review of stuff of why it occurred or whatever, it was an operator error where they, you know, selected the wrong button, because if we open up the doors on the right-hand side, the button's right by them. For them to open up the doors on the offside platform, they have to physically get up out of the seat and push the button on the other side. So as far as equipment failure, we haven't had anything of that, but we have had maybe a couple of employee items.
Ken Sundberg just informed me, two incidents that we've had where it had been resulted in human error where someone, you know, where the operator opened the door inadvertently.
Thank you. There's a recent incident where a mother, I believe, and got separated from her child because the carriage either got lodged in the door or the door closed, and led to a very healthy discussion at my house and with my wife, who had a similar experience at one point when she used the system. And all that I tried to do to explain how it could occur didn't go very very well. Can you give me a sense of what happens with our doors in those systems? What in terms of our alarms before the door closes, in terms of notification? My wife's response was one that the platforms are very crowded, and the alarm that occurs doesn't give enough notice that the door is going to close, and you don't have the opportunity to back up because people are pressing forward, and you get kind of stuck in a position where that can occur, which I had no defense for at the point.
We do have a, you know, an audio feature where it says the doors are closing. There's also a light that also flashes in the header panel to alert individuals to that the doors itself are, you know, are about to close. On this particular incident, it's really hard to say because, you know, again, the crowded platforms are definitely an issue. We do know that the individual, she pushed the unit or pushed her stroller into there while the doors and stuff, you know, were closing. We did dispatch staff, you know, at the very next station, you know, to catch up with this incident stuff that took place. We waited for the police actually were there on site because we wanted to make sure that, you know, make sure that the child was, you know, with the correct mother and everything else. And from a door operational perspective, you know, part of our requirement is for our operators to look outside of the window, you know, as they're closing the doors to make sure that, you know, they're not getting anybody caught or anything else. But there is a lot of traffic and stuff that's on there. Our doors do not have, you know, sensitive edges. You know, they're just the traditional, you know, subway type door. And that's the features and stuff of what we have. And then the other component is that the doors, by design, are supposed to come to a fully closed position, each individual door, and it has an interlocking that way. If that door was to remain ajar in that closing cycle or whatever, then the train would not, you know, move and, you know, proceed on without getting an all doors closed command. Yeah, and also, just to clarify, because this is where we do have, say, for instance, where we get sometimes a question about we had a door opening while it's moving. Once our door leaves closed here, for example, they'll close and they'll secure. Then there's a mechanical stop. There's a spring tension that holds them in place, and there's a little bit of travel. So if you were leaning on the door leaf while the car is going, you could move the door, you know, open it up just a little bit. And so we do get some reports of that where, you know, people are leaning on the door leaves, but that's by design, and that's just inherent with what we have. And we can also say that on the 7000 series design, we will have that feature eliminated, so that way whenever our doors are closed, we want them fully seated the rest of the way, so we'll be changing the design for the last 40 years.
I think I used all of those, but I don't, and I still lost the debate, but
Mr. Chairman, when you say with the current series that we have now, the door may open, you said just a little bit. Are you talking about how many inches maybe?
You could see probably about 2 inches of travel. That's okay. The door, again, the door has to go. It has to electrically, everything has to close. And then what will happen is in the mechanical, we'll lock it. But then after that, it's just spring tension that holds it. Yeah. And then,
so if you're leaning on
So if you're leaning on it, or say, for instance, if we have like an aggressive stop or whatever, and they don't have the spring tension set right, you could see just a little bit of travel. But you will see a gap.
About 2 inches.
About 2 inches.
And that will be rectified with the 7000 series.
We're traditionally going to be going to a new design. Yes, okay. But the existing fleets that we have, they would be like this until we retire them or replace them.
Correct. Okay, so you're saying also with the, this is what I was getting at before when I said the door is opening on the wrong side and then also door is closing, the incident with the mother and the toddler and the stroller. So you're also saying that because while our operators are supposed to look at it every single stop to just get a visual to make sure everything is safe, that may or may not have happened. We don't know, but it may have happened. But because it's so crowded, there may have been a visibility issue.
You know, that is correct.
The visibility may have been
impaired. On a six-car train, and you have people that, say, for instance, are walking on the truncated domes or real close to the cars and everything else, and they'll wait and wait and wait. And, you know, if they get an all doors closed, you know, while it's still crowded and stuff, then they know that, you know, all the doors have been properly closed, and then they could go ahead and proceed.
I appreciate, you know, the responsiveness and that you had someone at the very next station addressing it immediately, but we were all trying to figure out what happened because we had not had this information.
Yeah, so. We definitely did a thorough review of that, and you know, the operator, while the televisions, there was one side of it, we did have staff that was on site, and the operator responded. Supervisor was there. We had a station manager there, you know, at the next station and stuff to follow this.
But I think the board really needed to hear what happened.
I just wanted to know from a standpoint of us having done some, and I recall PR regarding children and parents and families in the system, how do you protect yourself? I've seen this incident in other situations and really much more graphically, and that is you're prying the doors open between the parent and the child. And the question is, what can we do to help alert parents? And we've done it before, because I've heard it before. We've talked about children staying close or holding hands on escalators. And I think this isn't one that's unusual. It may have gotten a lot of publicity this time, but if you've been in the system a lot, you've seen strollers go in and parents behind. And, you know, from a parent standpoint, I would think of it a different approach. And maybe there is an approach that we want to make sure that we're saying, because our doors are different than others. You get on an elevator, and if you stick your hand in, the door opens. It's not going to do so, and we need to continue to emphasize that. But it's even worse for children involved. So it seems like there's something more we can say to help parents aware that, you know, there's a different way you want to do this, because you don't want this condition to occur with this experience to occur with your child.
I do think that part of the issue was the response that we gave through media relations, which implied that we try to keep schedule by closing the doors, and that we don't have a policy that says, no, we do not separate mothers from their babies. our policy is you don't do that. This may have been an error, but we don't try to keep schedule by separating mothers from babies. I would just like to note.
You send a note home to my wife.
I'm happy to help there. I did have an interesting experience, however. A couple days later, I was at Metro Center, accompanied at that particular moment, because I met him on the platform, by one of our Metro Police sergeants. And we dutifully waited while everybody got off, and it was a fairly crowded train, and then we boarded, and I was ushered onto the train by the police sergeant. The doors closed as I was getting on, and closed with him outside, and my raincoat, which I was carrying, caught in the door. It was an interesting experience, because what happened was, looking up and down, there were, in fact, a substantial number of people still waiting to get on the train who had waited because they were letting people off. So one of the balances we have to make, I understand the importance of keeping schedules, is do we, in a situation like that, wait just a little bit longer in order to encourage people to not try and crowd onto the train while people are still getting off?
Well, that's one of the things we've discussed internally. The other thing that we've also looked at, again, it gets back to a manpower issue, but having a supervisor or somebody that's actually at a platform like a Metro Center or Gallery Place to be there kind of like as a visual aid, standing kind of in the middle of the platform and stuff, with the type of ridership and crowds that we do have is something that we try to work on a regular basis. So that would probably be, it gets back into manpower, gets into resources, but it's a very responsive and it's a very effective tool, especially when you have somebody with a vest or whatever there that's, because as you know, in other rail systems, you actually have a doorman or whatever, and that's all their job is to open and close doors and make sure that everything's clear while the operator is operating, the equipment. So we could look into that maybe a little bit. And I do know that, like, when we have major events and stuff, that's very effective.
Yeah, I know there's a natural tension that exists in this whole situation. One of the things we do want to do, however, is encourage our passengers to be polite, to wait, to get the most effective boarding and deboarding possible, and that doesn't get encouraged if we close the doors on passengers who've waited. In this particular case, a police sergeant and catching my raincoat in the door. So it's something we need to explore more.
Mr. McKay, for one last question on this.
Yeah, well, first, I appreciate this conversation because as someone who pushes a stroller on our system a lot, it's a challenge. And actually, the challenge has really little to do with the operator and more to do with other passengers. Mm-hmm. And no matter how many times we tell people to move to the center of the car, they don't do it. And if you're trying to get in with a stroller, there's nowhere for you to go. And so I don't know how to better communicate that. I think we communicate it really well, and people just unfortunately aren't listening a lot of times. But that's just a statement. My question is, what I see a lot while I'm riding on the train is the doors will close, and then you'll hear a sound, a thumping sound, and then they'll open again. And then the announcement will say, doors closing, and then they'll close again. And sometimes that happens two or three times before the train moves. What causes that? What is happening when that's taking place? Because as a rider, you don't know. I just assumed something was caught in the door and it triggered it to open again. What causes that to happen? It happens a lot.
Yes, it does. What the operators are doing there is that for them, all of the doors have to close and you have to get a lock on each respective door. Sometimes if they do not have if they don't get a signal for that door that's properly closed, they don't know if somebody is possibly keeping the door open or if they have a possible issue. The current rail cars that we have, there is no indication to say it's doors 5 and 6 on rail car 4000. So it's a train line where you have to open up the entire consist, and that also creates additional issues because whenever people see the doors open, then you have another tendency for people that are trying to board stuff at the last minute. So what the operators do is, they move the finger, they move it real fast, and what you're hearing, like the mechanical, when you're hearing that closing and that clunk, that's that mechanical device engaging to help, lock the doors, in place. And so that is an inherent design on the 1000s through the 6000 series. And so you don't, that's the way that this system has been developed, and that's what our operators face. What we're doing, for example, like on the 7000 series, again, another feature, is that we'll be able to hit the door close once, and the operator will actually have a screen that will give an indication on all the doors. And they'll actually be able to short cycle that specific doors which they might have a problem. It's going to save us a lot of time, and it'll also help, clear up a lot of errors instead of us having to open up, 8-car train sets of doors, throughout. But that's the process and the environment which they work with. And I hope that answered your question.
Yes.
Thank you. Can we move on now to the system safety plan?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to come to the board wherein actually the finalizing the process of pretty much rewriting our system safety program plan. And, the purpose of this information is to provide the committee with the information that is actually contained in the plan and which is required by not only federal regulation under what we call the 659 rule, the Tri-State Oversight Committee. It's a requirement in the program. So we have to review the plan, update it annually. However, with many of the changes going on, it's pretty much a total rewrite. And we'll be coming to the board, actually, with a new board policy. But this, you know, we have a little bit of a history as to why this started back in 1976. With the opening of the first segment of Metro Rail, actually it was a voluntary program under APTA. Then it became mandatory in 1996 with the state safety oversight rules. And then in 2005, the state safety oversight was revised again. Our 2010 SSPP revision will include information from the 2009 FTA audit that we received in March 2010. The NTSB reports, so that we make sure that we're meeting their recommendations, as well as the Tri-State Oversight's 2010 report and the 2010 Tri-State Oversight Program Standard that the TOC is actually in the midst of finalizing right now, along with the MOU that we're working on. And then it also includes some transit best practices. You know, some of the major modifications deals with how we communicate, how we get the information out to our employees, looking at the training that we talked about, incident investigation, hazard management, quite a few things which at another committee meeting we'd like to actually show you where we're going from an automated perspective so that things don't fall through the cracks, and how we conduct hazard analysis throughout the agency. So basically with that, we're going to be coming back to the board. I believe it would be as an action item, requesting the board to approve the new board system safety policy, which actually goes in the front of our system safety program plan.
In the appendix, you can see it takes four pages of table of contents to lay out all of the elements. Really, this is the playbook by which any department in the authority, any operator, knows what their responsibilities are with respect to safety. But at the front end, there will be a safety policy statement, replacing and updating the one that was adopted 3 years ago, to really drive from the top the concern that this be the playbook and this be what is followed. If you read the various safety reports from TOC and NTSB, one of the very most frequent observations is it's in the plan, it hasn't been executed appropriately. So adopting and updating the plan, I think, is very important. I also look forward to a discussion of the hazard analysis program. This is really the basis of saying what are the things that either have high likelihood of occurring or very high consequences, even though the likelihood may be low, so that we can in fact focus our attention on the things that we should in fact be worrying about. So we'll schedule that presentation in a future meeting. Mr. Benjamin.
Just a final request. It's a broad one. If you remember my question about the rail incidents, there are three of us here who are going through the packages actually as they were sent out to the board.
Yes, sir.
And when I was looking in the package that almost everybody else has in front of them, there appear to be some differences between what we received and what's in this package. And I just request that when you make those changes, you put blue pages in there so that we know that there's a difference, because the three of us were looking at something different from what anybody else was looking at.
Okay. I'm sorry. We will make sure that that is
thank you.
Followed forward.
It helps. Then I know, I have something they don't have.
We updated the board books last yesterday evening, but I apologize.
Any other questions?
I have an NTSB question when you're done with, if you're done with this report. When you commence discussions about the recommendations that NTSB has made, and then we say that they're satisfied, is there ever any debate whether they're satisfied or not? And if there is, who is the final arbiter of whether there is closure to it?
I can certainly only speak from past experience. I mean, there's discussion as to what satisfies, the recommendation. And, you know, most of the time there's, you know, we do have discussion between the group. For example, tomorrow afternoon I will be meeting with an NTSB individual that's involved in the reports. And we discuss it back and forth, certainly to make sure that we're on board and that we agree and that we're going to move forward in that direction. So there is certainly discussion. The ultimate decision comes between the general manager and the NTSB.
The ultimate decision is the NTSB, having dealt with them for years. If they believe something can be done, they will leave that as an open, unacceptable response until the end of time. At some point, you will get from them a closed, unacceptable, because we don't agree with what you've done, but we're going to go move on.
That takes a long time. So if I could just even real quickly jump back, and with the SSVP that we talked about, we believe with concurrence of the talk that will actually close 6 corrective actions.
Great. Electronic devices, which were a subject at the last meeting, and we asked for an update on that policy.
Yes, sir. Basically the purpose of the policy is, purpose of this presentation by the committee, with information regarding the zero tolerance electronic device policy, picking up on the discussion that occurred at last month's meeting, to provide you some background. Previously, in July 2009 was when a zero tolerance policy was put in place. The initial policy, actually at that point, provide the direction for operators, and what we've done is we moved the electronic devices must be turned off and out of sight. Any violation of that policy is termination, even for a first offense. However, the first policy did not include operations of non-revenue vehicles at different work facilities and types of the areas. So the new policy actually addresses that information or that lack and the discipline. Let's see, I apologize, skip the slides. I'm getting ahead trying to be cognizant of our time here. So we did have the policy. We did amend the policy. It includes the non-revenue vehicles. It included Metro-owned or leased vehicles, personal vehicles while on company business. Need to clarify that. And then the amended policy was not universal in its application. So we actually, we want to look at the cross-functional groups that were selected to focus on the policy, revise the policy. The policy was revised and circulated, or is circulating even currently at this time, with anticipated implementation by the end of this year. And, coming back, the board had asked, a question on the discipline. And since 2009, our review revealed approximately 25 employees violated the zero-based policy, 8 from rail and 17 from bus. The terminations were proposed, however, through the collective bargaining. Some individuals, I understand, were brought back. And moving forward into
on the use of equipment in personal vehicles, I am aware of instances of other employers who say you may not use your company-provided BlackBerry or a cell phone while driving, no matter where it is, where you are. That may be something to look at.
That's, and I believe that is covered, but also if they're on our business or acting as our agent, we didn't want them using even a personal phone where we would have that,
Mort.
The liability.
Mort, just a quick clarification, because when we're describing operators of buses and trains, we're talking about while they're moving. In other words, we'll frequently see a bus operator out of the bus, either they're ahead of schedule or something, and they'll be on the phone on the sidewalk next to the bus, just as an example. How does that fit into this? Is this only while our rolling stock is moving?
While they're in service. So that would take...
Well, they're in service.
But they're the buses. If they're outside of the vehicle, then it wouldn't apply. It's if they're in control or operating the vehicle. They're not allowed to use a stop at a red light, along that. But if they get off the vehicle, they're on their layover. But during when they're in service, the phone is to be stowed and in an off position. If they're on a proper layover, then yes, they'd be allowed to use
it. That's a very important distinction to make people understand, because I've had many passengers come up to me and complain. They'll see a bus operator talking on a cell phone, standing outside of the bus. And it was never really adequately explained through the process before, one would have automatically thought that was a violation of the policy. But what I'm hearing is that's not. That they have to, it's different if they're in the bus and the bus is moving than if the bus is stopped and they're standing outside of it.
That's
so it's
correct.
Completely permissible
on a break.
For an operator on a break to stand outside of their bus on a cell phone.
Yes, sir.
When he or she reboards the bus, the cell phone has to go
off and stowed. Yes.
Other questions?
The discipline you have had.
Yeah, can I talk about Yeah, let me just report on this. I attended the dinner on Tuesday, recognizing employees who have made extraordinary safety contributions. Among them, I forgot the exact number, was about 40 bus operators who collectively have driven 61 million miles without an accident. This is pretty impressive, pretty good. There are some of them up there.
Certainly, we believe certainly, as we're moving forward, recognizing employees for their outstanding performance throughout the agency, and we're looking forward to doing this on an annual basis.
At this point in the agenda, we had set some time aside to talk about escalators and also now the Farragut North event. I'll turn it over to Mr. Sarles.
late yesterday afternoon, we had an incident at Farragut North Station where D.C. Department of Transportation was working above us. And in their demolition activities, some concrete debris came down into the station through a ceiling tile. Brought that down. Through the extraordinary efforts of both DC DOT and our own staff, we were able to complete an inspection and do enough temporary covering up to get us back in operation this morning. But I'd like Dave Kubicek to just give you a little bit more detail on that.
What I've got here, I don't have like a formal presentation, but I do have some various pictures and stuff to kind of give you an idea of what was taking place out there last night. Okay. This is basically at the ground view. This is at the station, above the station on the actual street where they were doing some actual work and stuff. What they did here is that and some other slides we'll get to, that they actually used a kind of like a tractor or a backhoe with a pneumatic jackhammer. And basically that's what they were demoing, the concrete and everything else. And in this area right in here, this is close to what we call a station dome. We have the normal station that goes up that you see cosmetically and stuff inside, but also above this particular area, this was a cut and cover type station where it's very close to the ground or to the surface, and they actually have an additional dome that provides like ventilation access to the above ground. And so this area was very, very close to the dome. Next slide, please. This is actually the material from the dome that fell from the roof or from the ceiling. Actually fell off the dome through the ceiling panel, and this is what hit the platform. This is an actual what the material looked like that fell down there. Next slide, please. Okay, this is looking straight up from that location, and what you can see is where there's the dome above our ceiling was compromised, and where they were jackhammered, it kind of knurled or dislodged some of the other concrete and stuff, and so basically, what it did is if that concrete chunk fell directly on these panels, it could not sustain the weight, and then it came down as well. Next slide, please. This is just to kind of give you across the street view of where the work and stuff was taking place above the ground. Next slide. This kind of gives you a better idea. This area is probably about 150 to 200 feet long where they're doing demoing throughout. What you have here is this is what they were doing to replace. This is kind of like a great material that's above our station where we kind of get air and everything else. And this is where the dome is at. And what happened was that when they were jackhammering, it appears that they were too close to the dome and compromised that location. Next slide, please. And this kind of gives you an idea of where they were jackhammering and everything else. And again, where the locations of where they knew where they were supposed to be working at and where they were not, but the depth was not correct. Next slide, please.
I have a question on that, but I'll wait till you finish.
Okay. And this is just another shot of what was seen. Another slide, please. And also, this, if you see these points right in here, this is actually where the dome was compromised, and that's what basically dislodged the concrete behind that, and that's what fell down.
Could you give us an indication of what the policy is with respect to permitting work above our tunnels? What does a contractor or an agency have to do? What kind of coordination is there with respect to
what's underneath the ground. I mean, it's not like what happens sometimes when someone digs in and discovers the water line that was laid 200 years ago. We know where the tunnel is. We know what the plans are. How do we protect against this?
On this particular incident right in here, the D.C. Department of Transportation did contact us, and, you know, any work that is, you know, out there, we are involved in. There was a review of the drawings and the renderings, and actually this was a sub of the District of Columbia's, you know, Department of Transportation. So there was formal meetings. They knew where to dig. You know, we had people out there. Not on a full-time basis, but we do go through and monitor on this specific work. And, you know, we will have a full-time inspector, you know, to make sure that we have somebody around the clock when they're doing this kind of excavation and type of work.
I assume we will have the ability in that case to charge them back for the time of the inspector?
Yes.
In looking at the location of where it fell and what was there, and just thinking future, is there anything that we would want to do to avoid against the possibility of that happening and how we would protect our customers? For example, I know that when we say we're out there and we're cutting and we've Miss Utility has told us exactly where everything is, there's a little different of an impact. You lose the power and we're all okay until they turn it back on. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, that the chance of injury, and I wondered, is there something we might want to do to isolate that, or to, that is, on our side in the station area, so that in case they do have that problem, we don't face what could have been a very...
We're going to do a thorough review with DC on this, you know, particular incident to see what type of drawings, what type of renderings they had, the people that they had out there that were doing the review and the inspection, as well as internally of WMATA. Again, we know that this is a shallow station, so we'll definitely on our part shore up, you know, our involvement on the process while people are working, you know, above our grade on
this. And we have tunnel properties in other jurisdictions as well, right?
Yes. And so that's something that we'll, you know, continue to review on this overall effort.
We're going to have to look at what we mark out ahead of time and the extent of our monitoring during the construction, including full-time inspectors, which
we have. I understand we have an adjacent construction team, or how do they correlate with the work that's being done on
they were involved in this, you know, process as far as the setup and the work and everything else, and so they've been drawn into this, as well as our core construction team, as well as our maintenance team. That they all three were out there yesterday evening and throughout the night and this morning in inspecting it, and that was the other component of this, is that we did go through and do a thorough investigation of all of that entire length that you saw demoed. So you might see some panels or whatever there were dropped down or whatever, but we're going to kind of leave those things down because the work was halted. There was no mechanical or heavy-duty equipment because we didn't want to compromise it, you know, any farther. They dug down. They feel very comfortable, and now the reviews, you know, with the district are ongoing.
Wow, long answer to that question. What exactly is the role of the adjacent construction team, and how do they position themselves during process of this time, this type of construction being done as a rule? How do they function in?
Yeah, as a rule, they're involved with the, you know, the work plans. You know, what type of work and stuff that, you know, is taking place. And they're the direct pipeline for us, you know, working with any entity external of the agency.
Are they there during the course of the construction?
They are not there 100%, you know, full time, but there is a lot of site work. There's a lot of prep work, and that's one of the things that we're reviewing, is to say, you know, who was the inspector on charge that was in charge of this activity? What drawings, what as-built and stuff, you know, were provided, you know, during the review of this process?
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, a question on all construction in our area. Do we routinely get contacted by agencies in the area about construction that potentially could be over our tunnels?
Yes.
And I assume that that includes we've already given all these jurisdictions schematics which show where all our tunnels are and under what roads and locations.
What I will say is that each specific effort is really a case-by-case review.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say that we always get notified 100% because we have been out there and seen where people were working adjacent to our railroad or close to our vent shafts, and then we'll get called by, you know, one of our inspectors or somebody else that's taking place. But there is a formal review process because it's very important. You know, as-built, as we all know, might not always be 100% correct. And so you need to have the staff involved, and there also has to be a field review that's taking place. And what I say, one of the biggest components is the firsthand involvement while they were doing this demolition work.
Yeah. Are you anticipating having to put some sort of shelter over that part of the station in the interim, or some sort of catching system of anything that could fall?
We were able to gain access through the various panels. And so all the concrete and everything else, you know, has been removed and taken care of. They're in the process of digging it up from the top. The district laid some plastic and everything else. We took measures also to protect it, you know, internally as well. So there are measures, you know, internally what we can do as well as what's at grade. And that's what they're working on, trying to resolve a long-term process, you know, to fix this thing properly.
Other questions on this issue? Let me ask Mr. Graham, we're about to impinge on your time, but we have a little discussion of escalators to go. Are we okay to go with that? All right, can we move to escalators?
If I could ask our Deputy Chief Rail Safety Bob Mishka to provide that update.
Hello again. The Department of Safety would like to provide an update to the ongoing investigation of the LaFont Escalade accident that occurred October 30th, 2010, and to answer some of the specific inquiries that were made from the board. Escalator number 2 was the unit involved in the incident. It is a Westinghouse Modular 100. An additional piece of fact is that it has 199 steps. It's 112 feet long along the incline, with an additional 8 feet when you add the flat steps. Of the Metro's 588 escalators system-wide, there are, and this is the breakdown that was requested by Mr. McKay, there are 430 Westinghouse Modular 100s, 59 Westinghouse Modular 250, 9 Schindler, 49 Fujitech, 20 Montgomery, 8 O&K, 6 APV Bakers, and 7 Cones. Escalator 2 had been running in the ascending direction, which I reported before. We verified through the download of the PLC information, which I'll talk about in a minute, that this occurred approximately 2 minutes prior to the incident. This does not appear to have any influence on the operational issue. The escalator's motors stopped due to an overspeed fault. This fault was triggered when the normal speed of the escalator, 90 feet per minute, is exceeded by 10%.
Is that the function of the number of people who were on it at the time? Or just
that's the normal speed of the escalator.
But when it speeds up,
there can be other contributing
factors.
So did I give the right answer, Dave, on that?
On that right there, part of it was, again, due to the loading. You know, you've got the gravity of all the weight with the unit operating downward, and then as additional people get in there are on the unit, it does have a tendency, you know, to accelerate the speed.
And the overspeed cutoff is to respond to that.
Yes, yes.
Last time I talked about the three motors, I wanted to expand a little bit on that. There are three motors. Those three motors are connected to gearboxes via a belt. Each gearbox has one brake, so the brake is actually on the gearbox, not the motor. One of the brakes, DU3, had oily, dirty brakes from a leaking seal on the gearbox shaft. One brake, DU2, showed brake pad wear down to the metal. The last time I talked about the third brake's pads being found in good condition, and that is true. However, there was a set screw on the side of the brake that was loose. When they recreated and went back to test, several actuations of the brake indicated erratic performance of this brake. So that's updated. The last scheduled maintenance we indicated was September 28, 2010. This was a scheduled quarterly maintenance inspection. Torque testing is what is used to test the braking. The torque testing revealed that on DU1, there was 220 foot-pounds, on DU2, 130 foot-pounds, and on DU3, 110 foot-pounds. Based on these torque readings, Metro would not have considered taking this unit out of service prior to the incident. The note here is that Metro schedules replacement if below 90 foot-pounds and immediate replacement if the reading is below 70 foot-pounds. The elevator escalator repair log, which is maintained at LaFont Plaza, dated 9-28-10, indicates that the quarterly inspection was completed at 5:20 a.m. This was verified by the mechanics that performed the work and by checking the handwritten log kept in the kiosk. The computerized maintenance system, or the Maximo system used to track work orders, had an indication of task ID number 10, which means incompleted escalator quarterly inspection. The unit was returned to service. The safety department is investigating this further with Ellis to explain the discrepancy between the handwritten logs and the Ellis Operations Center, or EOC's, generated electronic log. The mechanics that performed the work verified that this quarterly maintenance was complete, and the work was further confirmed with the handwritten log kept at the station kiosk. The escalator PM, or handwritten check sheet, did not have box number 22, which under the C-level maintenance indicates brakes, checked off, indicating the status the box checked, which indicates the status. But it did have the results of the torque testing written in it. So those numbers I gave you earlier were handwritten, but they forgot to check the box. When we asked the mechanic that completed the form, he stated that he considered his written results to be an indication that this task was completed. The prior periodic maintenance that was done on this escalator was started August 31st and concluded on September 1st, 2010. A visual check of the brakes was made, and it was noted that the brakes at DU1 were bad, and the brake was replaced on 9-1-10. So that goes with DU1 having good brake pads. The periodic maintenance done on 8-31 and the quarterly maintenance done on 928 do not indicate any leaking gearbox at DU3. VTX was on site Wednesday, November 10th, to perform their independent investigation into this incident. Safety and Ellis are awaiting the results from VTX. As of November 17th, 2010, 568 escalators have had the braking systems inspected. Of the 568 escalators that were checked, 40 brakes have been replaced. 10 brakes were found to have oil on them from a leaking seal on the gearbox shaft. These have been repaired. And 16 escalator units were placed out of service pending the arrival of replacement brake pads. It should be noted that 20 escalators were not checked due to their undergoing either rehab or major repairs. The braking systems of these units will be inspected prior to returning the units to operation. Alan Bradley, the manufacturer of the Programmable Logic Controller, PLC, was on site November 3rd, 2010, to assist Metro Ellis personnel with the recovery of the data from the programmable logic control. This data was captured and preserved as part of the investigative effort. The five faults that correspond with the event are listed below. At 1:21, there was a fault indicating a running down start. What this is that the unit had been turned to running in the down direction. That was done by the station manager, as we indicated earlier. At 1:23, there was an indication of a step band overspeed trip. So the overspeed was detected and tripped. This causes the brakes to apply. At 1:23:43 seconds, the right up thrust switch tripped. This is probably due to the customers piling up on the step riser at the bottom of the escalator. And what that's designed to do is it prevents a step that is up on the flat portion from running into the comb plates at the end and destroying the entire escalator. At 1:23:51, the top e-stop was closed. So the emergency stop button at 1:23:51 was closed. The elapsed time of the start of the event to the end was the 18 seconds. While the investigation continues, findings include that the immediate cause of this accident was the failure of the braking system to stop the escalator when the overspeed safety switch activated and shut down the drive unit motors. Contributing causes could include the increased load on the escalator due to the riding crowds from the Restore Sanity Rally, the loose set screw on the side of the brake on DU1, the worn brake pads on brake DU2, and oil on the brake DU3 from the leaking motor seal.
DU1 was the brake that was recently replaced.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Which prompts our next step, obviously, when we ask our five whys. Mitigations to prevent reoccurrence. Thus far, on November 4th, 2010, WMATA Ellis Department began a program to inspect the braking systems of the 588 escalators that are in service. All other maintenance projects were placed on hold until the inspections were complete, which has taken place with the exception of the remaining 20 units undergoing replacement or rehabilitation. The current procedures that are used by Ellis will be modified to have the brakes tested monthly instead of quarterly. The safety department is continuing to review other related information as part of this investigation. VTX was hired to conduct an independent investigation into the incident. VTX representatives visited the site on November 10th, and the report is pending. WMATA is currently looking at any design modifications that were made that could have potentially contributed to this accident. And currently, WMATA Safety is reviewing the comprehensive final VTX assessment of WMATA's escalators and elevator report of November 15th, 2010. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Yeah, I at the last meeting when we discussed the capital program, I had asked for an enumeration of the money we're investing in escalators, and it was in a couple categories. There was money that wasn't specifically called out relating to escalator and elevator work, and I haven't seen that yet. My hunch is, and I could be corrected when I see the data, but my hunch is that it didn't look to me like enough capital money was being put in to the escalators and elevators. Specifically, we have escalators that we now know are 40-plus years old. We have escalators that are anomalies. I don't remember the statistic, but we have some of the longest escalators you can find anywhere. And it calls to question, at what point in time do you stop repairing and rehabilitating some of these, and at what point in time do you just outright replace the entire unit? And if you have ones that are long and are anomalies, at what point do you break them down into smaller ones, start investing capital and redesigning
the way you get in and out of some of these stations, because what I just heard, for all the engineers in the room, may have been completely understood. To riders who see these units out all the time, the legitimate question is, when do you stop repairing and when do you start outright replacing, and when do you reflect that in the capital budget? And so I hope that we give some serious thought to that, and we're not just chasing our tail doing rehabilitations and repairs all the time, and that we actually look at when you tear these out and when you just outright replace them.
Yeah, I just want to respond. Hey, I apologize. I actually gave that information at the NVTC meeting. I forgot to give it to the entire board, so I'll make sure it gets to the board. you're right in the questions you ask, and we'll get you answers on that. But the basic thing that has come out of the VTX report is, and I agree we should be doing the rehabs, we should be doing replacements, but the basic thing is we should be doing basic good maintenance to the apparently good standards we have. And until we do that right, we're going to just have problems we shouldn't have. Not to say
this equipment may be high maintenance, but that just means we have to maintain it.
We got to spend the money to do it, and we got to spend the right effort to do it, and we got to manage it right. And that's why, you know, Dave has developed an approach over the next 6 months to improve on that. And I have asked that VTX come back in 6 months to see if we've made progress on doing the basic maintenance. We're not going to solve the problem in 6 months, but make progress. If we have made progress, as I said last time, we're going to take drastic actions to do something different. It's totally different than we're doing today.
Right. Just to follow up more real quickly, just to follow up on that, and I appreciate that answer. I guess what I don't understand is, what is the typical life cycle of an escalator in this world, especially one that runs the amount of hours ours do, some that are exposed to elements that are outdoors? You know, what is the expected life cycle? I mean, if you have a car for 40 years, even the best maintenance sometimes can't keep that running and alive. And so, you know, fundamentally, what I'd like to hear too is, what do we see around the region? What do we see around the country as to what is the expected life cycle of these to begin with, even if you had superior maintenance?
I could give you my answer, but I'm not the expert. I have some, you know, general experience. What I'd like to do is have VTX, the expert, prepare a paper, okay, that answers those particular questions
to provide to the board. Just as we have a bus service plan and bus equipment plan, we probably need a vertical transportation equipment plan.
Yes.
Mr. Graham is going to reclaim his time.
I'll take advantage of that.
Yeah.
First, I want to thank the staff for the very careful review that they have done here, and it's very much appreciated. Mr. Kubitschek was good enough to loan me his written copy of this, so I was able to follow it, because at a certain point there's so much detail that it's hard to follow. Thank you very much, Mr. Kubitschek.
You're welcome.
What concerns me, and what I'd like to have the staff comment on, is the fact that they found that there were 568 escalators that had the braking systems that were inspected. Of that 568 escalators that were checked, 40 brakes. 10 brakes were found to have oil on them from a leaking seal, and those were repaired. So there's 50 brakes that were either replaced or repaired, and 16 escalator units were placed out of service pending the arrival of replacement brake pads. I guess that 16 is included in the 50. Is that over and above?
That's my understanding. That's included in that.
In the 50. And then 20 escalators were not checked due to the fact that they were undergoing other rehabilitation. So the point is that there were 50 escalators that had this braking system that required significant, relevant repairs. And so that's just under 10% of the total number of escalators that had this braking system. Does that concern the general manager? I mean, are you surprised that that larger percentage of our escalators would be evidencing the problems very similar to what resulted in this incident?
My view, we shouldn't have a number like that. and that's why we have to do some of the things that were talked about earlier, planes, increasing the frequency of inspections. It also goes to changing our getting our maintenance practices to where they should be.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I think this prompts an additional request for information, which is I'd like to see just what the maintenance record, recent maintenance record, was regarding these 50 braking systems, so that we can have a better indication, better idea of just what preceded these replacements and repairs.
Are these 50 escalators going through the normal cycle, and if so, why are they still
right.
defective?
We don't have that, because this is very nearly 10%. We found out that 10% of our escalators that had the same braking system, you know, could very well result in a similar incident as a result of the conditions, and that's of great concern to me. Thank you.
One more question, and then we'll adjourn the.
I'm a little concerned about. I walked into this meeting this morning with some of the same views that Mr. McKay had, and after I walked up the escalator at Judiciary Square and walked down the one escalator that was working at Wheaton on my way down here, it was, you know, I'm a customer who's just kind of fed up with repairs. Maintenance ongoingly, and it seems like over, I guess now, two decades that I've been in the Washington metropolitan region, there has been continued studies, investments in repair and maintenance through four or five general managers. Some of you have been here on the board doing all of that, and I know Mr. Graham has dealt with this for years, and also Mr. Zimmerman. And I also looked at the Washington Report story, which seemed to suggest that we have some escalators that just are faulty in their construction and their design, that are creating problems across the country. And the question is, do we continue, no matter what kind of great maintenance you apply, the question is whether or not we have some faulty design issues that suggest we should rip them out and replace them. And replace them with some more functional escalators that have a different design, that's more designed with the challenges that we face in this region, so that once and for all, we have a systematic plan that says 5 years from now, our riders at certain stations will understand that there's going to be some reliability in the elevators and escalators. And in addition to that, the maintenance dollars and the rehab dollars that we're constantly pouring into this, it was seen to me at that point those operating costs would start dwindling. So, you know, I'm really not that excited about hearing another maintenance plan and what our maintenance schedule has been and what we have not applied, because it sounds like I've heard it before. To be honest with you, and not just with you, Mr. Sauls, but you know, over the last two decades. So, you know, I want to see what is our going forward plan to solve the problem, really.
Let me respond to that. We can talk about replacing 400 escalators, and we can. And it'll cost you a lot of money, and you'll have to do it eventually. It'll also take a lot of time, and we should have the plan, and we should do that. However, you can't look to the capital program to solve the problem today. You have to do the maintenance today. You have to do it to the right standards, and then do these other things to eventually get you to where you want to be. We cannot lose focus on the day-to-day maintenance in hopes that the capital plan will get us there.
We're getting into an argument because I'm not suggesting that we do, but what I'm suggesting is we have never looked at the long-term plan. You know, that's my concern.
So if we could have a long-term plan, we could look at that. But in the meantime, maintaining is absolutely critical. Ms. Hutchins and Mr. Zimmerman, and then we'll close down.
I appreciate what the general manager said, and I really do understand why we're so frustrated. But I want to go back to another question that came to me that I found interesting, and why I think the question is important is that if that is where we're going, let us be consistent in following that. And I'd like to know why we were off track if the prior plans said so. And my understanding is that there was a study in 1990 that said pretty much the same of where we are today. And if we thought we were following it, where did we get off? And I think that's where you are saying, but I think we need to be able to look back and be able to measure where we're going based upon that. Because from my understanding, we were with some of the same kinds of issues. And therefore, some board took an action regarding that study. And if we're going to take an action, I think we need to learn from that and make sure that we're moving to something that is consistently.
I think this goes back to what Chris raised at the last meeting, Chris Emmerman, which is we should have good performance indicators that show the progress we're making against the plan as well as the progress we're making on maintenance. And stick with it.
Well, that actually is one of the main points that I was going to make. But first let me say that I think Mr. Litton well expressed my feeling of frustration. So I won't repeat that, but what he said. And it really is that, you know, if you've been around here a while, you know it's not like we haven't been looking at these things. It's not like we haven't tried asking every kind of question, looking at the, is it a particular type of escalator? Is it a particular condition of the escalator? It isn't like we haven't said, show us a plan for fixing that. And then it isn't like we haven't funded it because, you know, we put millions and millions specifically into addressing escalator and elevator problems in various ways. Some of them are the obvious things like the canopies. Some of them are not so obvious, but if you go back through, you know, the records of all this, and I'm sure, you know, staff can tell you, the various things that have been tried. Take this in-house, take it out-of-house. We need more mechanics. We have to do things to train more specialized mechanics. And I mean, you can go, there is a long list. Mr. Graham's effort to bring, you know, highlight to specific problems, if there were particular ones, through the Dirty Dozen or whatever it became list. There are a lot of things that have been tried here, and yet we have a report that says, wow, a month before the recent, you know, incident, there was something internal that said that this could happen or whatever it is, which in part is what brought me to what I was going to say, that I appreciate Mr. Sarles remembering that, you know, it is really, it is, this is an example of where we need to make sure we have performance measures that relate to the things we're trying to address here. And we need to be able to measure whether the implementation actions are pursuing a policy goal. And if they're not, to say, okay, well, why isn't this working? And that's the biggest frustration for me, is that we're no closer to that, it would seem, on the basis of this. I was also struck by, you know, a recent communication in the latest, and, you know, again, I hope the thing that the general manager is trying now is the right thing to do right now. It's the best. I don't have any reason to doubt it. Of course, I didn't have any reason to doubt that, you know, the last bunch of experts that, you know, had a plan. But there was, you know, a remark, Mr. Sarles, that you made about something to get to the heart of the matter or something like that. And that kind of jumped out at me because I thought, well, isn't that what everybody was saying they were doing? You know, part of the question here is, what is the heart of the matter? Mr. Linton was raising another potential for that. Maybe it's just the escalators are no good. Or maybe they're just so old they need to be replaced. Remind me just roughly what an escalator, one escalator cost if you had to buy a new one. Just ballpark figure, the nearest 100,000.
Depending upon the length and stuff, you could be up to $1 million.
Okay, so at $1 million a piece, there are 400 of them. Just so we understand the order of magnitude, if you're going to replace 400 escalators. I don't know. But if what we were doing before wasn't getting to the heart of the matter, how is this getting to the heart of the matter? How do we know this is the heart of the matter? Perhaps you can address that question, Mr. Sarles.
Your crystal ball, Mr.
When you're not doing your basic maintenance, you're going to have all these issues, and you're going to have to rehab your escalators earlier and everything else. So what I believe, and I've always believed, not just with escalators, you got to do your basic maintenance first. That's the heart. And it's true that eventually, from an economic basis, you spend too much maintenance. You spend too much money on maintenance of a particular piece of machinery, and then you should replace it. But I don't think it. And it's so that's why I say it's a hard matter.
Step right there. Yeah. So the suggestion is that
with adequate maintenance, you wouldn't have a lot of these problems, and therefore we haven't been doing adequate maintenance.
That's what came out of the VTX report.
And so that brings us back to the question, the immediate thing. How do we have measures by which the board can know we are or are not doing enough adequate maintenance? Because certainly, you know, the basic statement you made is made all the time for all of our equipment, mm-hmm. you know, the operation of a bus, an escalator, whatever it is. And when we do our budget,
should
our
not be the indicator of
that.
Failure should not be the indicator.
Exactly, yeah. Other than something going wrong or breaking, how can we know on an ongoing basis at this level that we have adequately funded and that you have an adequate program for ongoing maintenance, not only for escalators, but for anything else?
And we've tasked ourselves to come up with those performance measures. In fact, we were just discussing it in the last couple of days. We don't have the performance measures yet, but working with our own folks and with our experts, we're going to come up with those performance measures.
The other thing I would ask for that, just finally, is that when you do that, also generate for us the number that says, here's how much more it should have been or should be. You know, what is the gap between what we have funded this particular activity mm-hmm. and what it would be to meet the standard you're saying we should meet?
We'll try to get an estimate of that.
Yep. Mr. Graham, you want to close?
I just want to add to what Mr. Zimmerman said, which I agree with. But we've got an indicator. Now, we have 50 braking systems. We've just been told 50 braking systems, perhaps for the want of proper maintenance, perhaps for some other reason because we're not, are failing or could fail and could result in a similar, if not identical, incident as what previously happened at Longfang. We've been told this. And so I think at this point, and I'm repeating myself, but it will only be brief, that we need to know, we need to take these 50 as an example and say, what was the maintenance? And I guess now after this conversation, I would add, would the maintenance have made a difference? Or are we at the point where the car is just broken down and we have to replace it? But I think we have the thread here that we can follow and get a very good sense of what's going on without making anybody wrong or anything else. I mean, we now know where the problem lies and how serious it is.
I mean, these are basically mechanical devices about which we should be able to know what makes them work and not. I mean, this isn't like we have to get an exorcist in to say, get rid of the evil spirits. It can be fixed. I think we just need the plan as to how that can happen. Any other comments, Marcel, and then I'll close.
You mentioned you were coming up with a plan. When do you think you'll have that ready for the board to review?
Well, Dave has a few PowerPoint slides, three, I think, which starts to talk about that and gives you some time frames. It's just the beginning, but if you want, take 2 minutes to go through it.
Why don't we, unless you want to go with that or put those off to another? Is that all right with you? Yeah. Three slides, 3 minutes.
Yeah. I promise it's not 10. Okay. Action items, you know, underway. We have completed, you know, the brake inspection across the board, you know, for all the escalators, with the exception of the 20 units that are held for the capital process. We've already contracted, you know, for the cleaning of the escalator pits to start that process, to start getting the housekeeping addressed, not only internally, but also getting external resources to support, to augment, so that we can accelerate this. We've completed the initial reviews for supervisor positions to make sure that we're filling vacancies. And there's also an internal review that's taken place for the equity of payment, for compensation, so that we can get qualified individuals to help address these systems. We've already started the lighting survey review. That will involve not only Ellis, but it also, the key of that will be the engineering from a design standpoint and the maintenance departments that are supposed to support this equipment to ensure that our employees are working in a safe environment, as well as the water intrusion plant. That has already begun, where we're doing site-specific reviews for escalators and elevators. The other thing that we put in there is that we have publicly released the entire vertical transportation excellence report, the complete report. A lot of technical information in there, and I don't want to belabor it, but a lot of good information that came out, and it does focus on the basics. And there was some good findings for us, and there were some other areas that helped clarify it. It'll help us moving forward. Next slide. Clarify on this, Foggy Bottom escalator replacement. There was question. We've reached out to the university, working with the hospital. Foggy Bottom is going to get brand-new escalators that are built in 2010 with a more industrial application. They are not going to be a replace-in-kind approach. Okay, this is a brand-new industrial design, which we feel is more fitting for our application, as well as we're working also with the district to make sure that we can put a canopy above that entrance. And that's the station that we're also moving everything over, and we're actually putting in a set of stairs. So that way we maximize the template for that station there. I'd also like to add that right there is probably going to take upwards of 50 weeks, because we're going to have one unit down and shifting over, and that's why we've been reaching out to the various parties, the various stakeholders in that specific station, so they know what's taking place. Also, what we've got underway is that we're going to have VTX that's going to come in to train us on the basics, so that way we can start some more aggressive auditing with our QA officers, our safety staff, and also our supervisors. There's got to be, it's one thing for us to say that we inspected it, but there's got to be an additional check and an additional check on top of that, because we're talking about basic maintenance functions. If we complete those, we'll go a long way. Complete refresher training maintenance standards and equipment familiarization. Every technician that we have will go through a new and refreshed familiarization plan and will be completed by December. Every technician, and that will include supervision and management. Commence specific component inspection replacement campaigns. I put this in here because, just like what we did on the brakes, where we went out and we checked everything throughout the entire system, I plan on having additional campaigns that might be pinpoint on certain type of systems that are supporting these elevator and escalators, so that way we don't wait for years to get an input or 6 or 8 months to try to get a trend line. We want this information in a matter of weeks as we adjust our maintenance programs and our efforts to address these. Also, safety will start working with us as well, where they'll be monitoring the audits done by the quality department, as well as they will have the ring to get in there and review whatever has been followed in as well. Next slide. We were talking about performance matrices. These are just some random ideas that we're looking at. We're working with the chief performance officer because it has to tie in with vital signs, and it has to have some validity to it, and we have to develop a real-time system. One of the things that the reports directly, came out was that our Maximo system, our maintenance database system, needs a lot of work, and it needs to be, brought up to speed. But, for example, one of the things we think is very important, we need to know, monthly PMs on all types of equipment. That also is important because in that way we know where to send our auditors. Our supervisors should be following up on this. Capital projects. How many did we actually complete? Are we maintaining that schedule? How many did we start for the month? Third-party inspections. That is going to be specific. Say, for instance, it's going to tie into accident and incidents. For example, we had an incident, and where we have to have a representative either from Maryland or the district or Virginia, that we're going to track that time to say we did all of our work in our review, but that inspector process took an additional X amount of days to make sure that, we're aware of the timeliness of everything. Response to incidents. This will get into where we'll work with safety and the chief performance officer to kind of distinguish between slip, trips, and falls on escalators, actual transport, actual, hard failures of these units. And then the other one would be quality trend reports. Basically, what that's kind of feeding into is we say we did 197 inspections. Of those 197 inspections, if we go out and we audit 20 of them, what were the findings of that? Are we truly following what is documented and what is required to perform the basic functions, of these units? And there's several other items that we're looking at behind the scenes, but this is just kind of a start. And, it's our hope to start doing this on a monthly basis so that way it's readily available. And all of these functions, why we pick these, it's about capital, it's about basic maintenance, it's about real-time information that we're facing on a day-to-day basis, and we have to get ourselves structured to monitor at that level in real time.
I think that's very much what we need. I think it relates to what Mr. Zimmerman was saying. I hope we will see that in reports at his committee. I think we should also get, for your first two slides, where you've initiated a number of steps, an update in 3 months as to how much of that has been completed. Anything else? We go to the order? If not, we'll adjourn the meeting and turn it over to Mr. Graham.